to order the meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. First item on our agenda is approval of the agenda. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to the agenda? Without comment, the agenda will be regarded as approved as presented. Any objection? Okay. Minutes. We have before us the minutes of January 13th, 2011. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Without objection, the minutes are also approved. Our first item is an action item. It's on Dulles Phase 2, and Mr. Kubicek.
Yeah. Good morning. I'll have Mr. Thomas go through the presentation if there's any questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Here today to obtain committee approval to add 12 positions to the capital program to support phases 1 and 2 of the Dulles project. Next slide. Thank you. Next slide is a route map, just to, as a quick refresher of the extent of the rail project. Phase 1 on the third slide is the one that's under construction now from East Falls Church out to Wheelie Avenue. The second phase will pick up from Wheelie Avenue and go out to Loudoun County past the airport. The additional positions, we're looking to expand the project team to have better oversight of phase one of the project as construction is in its peak now, leading up to the testing and acceptance phase, which is probably going to start in about 2 years. The positions we're looking to add will include those involved in project management as well as quality assurance. And we then, given the timing of the phase one and phase two, we expect those personnel will then roll right into phase two of the project. So the recommendation is to approval to add 12 positions of the capital program to support phase one and phase two of the Dulles Rail extension.
Ms. Hutchins?
This approval is before us because Metro is the will be the operating entity for this, and the standards we accept must be consistent from the builder from the rail project.
Absolutely.
The personnel are clearly that, and it's a reimbursable project.
Yes, a reimbursable project.
Just with that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the item.
Is there a second? There is a second. Any other questions or comments? I did want to just make clear what we're saying is at the end of this reimbursable, any person who's hired, unless there's another job available for them, is no longer on our payroll?
That's correct.
So all the capital positions that we keep talking about that we're adding on are temporary positions until such time as that project is over, at which time, if there are not other capital projects, they don't just slip into the operating budget. Okay, and the people who are being hired understand that?
Yes, we'll make that absolutely.
There was a time when we had what we called temporary positions. Are these those kinds of positions, or are they permanent positions?
We've been typically advertising them as temporary positions to make sure that it's understood that that's the case.
And there are provisions in everybody's employment agreement or whatever the basis is for their employment, that they are employed only so long as there is funding for them.
That's correct.
Because we're going to no doubt have to deal with this at some time in the future when some of this stuff ramps back down again. Yes, and finally, when we have a disagreement with the airport's authority over what is being built, in the end, we're going to have to operate this. And clearly, their interest right now is to build as good a project as they can within the number of dollars available. And that's, as you know, John, a very strong constraint with the number of dollars available. What happens when we look at it and we say, hey, this is not the right thing to be doing right here?
There's the, within the agreement we have with MWA, there's a disputes clause that goes up the food chain, if you will. We've invoked it once about 3 years ago where it had to go one step higher than my position, but everything else has been basically resolved at my level. Mr. Kubicek's been involved in a few things, but not as a formal dispute with the airport's authority.
So the purpose of having these people is to make sure that the system, when it is turned over, is operable and at our standards?
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other comments? Are we ready to vote? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay. Our next item is our budget update.
Good morning. This presentation of the FY12 portion of the operating budget will focus specifically on Metro expenditures, highlighting the plans that we have implemented to contain expenditures as proposed in the general manager's budget, and then some of the review of the structural cost changes that we have made that have been determined, and then an overall look at a year-to-year comparison of prior years on where we are, the trends of our expenditures. We intend to actually have a similar review on revenue and our capital budget. So the capital review is scheduled for March, and then we'll have a revenue analysis scheduled for April, hopefully with an adopted budget to come forward in May and June. So,
could I ask a question?
Just to make sure I understand. Mm-hmm. There's no fundamental change in this proposal from what we saw a month ago. We're just going to greater depth on one aspect of it, and we'll do the same again, but it's not a moving target.
No, this is really the premise of what you'll see today is all what's in the CEO's proposed budget that was delivered in January. So really, as you said, we're just peeling back the layers of the onion and looking at the detailed expenditures and answering any questions that the committee has on our proposed budget.
So. I think that's a very good point. This is our opportunity as board and as the finance committee to take a look in more depth at the proposed expenditures and have a better understanding as to what is being proposed and how much of that we think we agree or disagree with, and make sure that we are comfortable with the numbers as we move forward.
So if you go to page, I'm going to skip a few slides, but if you go to page, this slide 17, actually it's the next. No, it's the slide you had before. I'm sorry, page 17. So as we indicated last month, the overall review of Metro's operating cost structure indicates that about 90% of our operating budget is dedicated to core services. And 9% is the support services that are the success criteria to make that happen, basically. And when we looked at comparative analysis with other transits, we're at the low end of that. It ranges anywhere between 8 to 13%, as I indicated last month. So it just says that we're at the low end, we're efficient on our operating structure. On page 18, I wanted to resurrect this crosswalk table, which I had showed you last month, and just highlight a couple of things. The table here represents basically the November forecast crosswalk to the proposed budget of FY12, and it serves as a highlight to what are the changes that are derived from that. The predominant changes that we spoke about last month are really the major increases, and they attributed to labor and fringe benefits, the $43.7 million that you see there, Metro Access, which in total in the top part of the chart is 9.7, and then an additional 3.7 on the bottom. So in total, the Metro Access increase year over year, you will see, and I'll talk about that later, is expected to be $13 million, but we'll talk about mitigating plans for that later in this presentation. And then the major decreases that you see on this from the forecast to the budget on 12 is really the structural changes that I spoke to you about last month, and I'll review again today. The structural changes are in two different categories. One category is actually eliminating and reducing cost, taking cost out of the picture, still sustaining the core level of services that we provide, so not impacting service. And the second structural changes that we talked about, the $49 million on the bottom, are really structural changes where we've identified operating costs that should be capital. overhaul shops that I have identified, rail and bus, parts and labor that should be capitalized cost. So those are the two major differences, and I want to highlight this on the crosswalk chart for you.
Ask a question on that. When you make this identification, what you're saying is these actually meet the test of being capitalizable, that the accountants would be comfortable with them going on the balance sheet. This is not just a transfer of money for budgetary purposes.
Well, it's a good question. We have a very rigorous process in our accounting. It has to meet the GAAP guidelines. It has to meet the test that we've defined in our comptroller's manual that says this is a cost that extends the useful life of an asset. It has to meet the dollar level test, and all those things are done prior to that actually occurring. So,
but to the extent we do this, we are encumbering a greater portion of our capital program for legitimate but not previously identified capital costs.
That's correct. Yeah. So the shift happens, and yes, you're going to have that shift and impact your capital budget. We've actually assumed that shift in the capital budget. So as we proposed the budget in January, it assumes this shift in the capital budget.
And on the chart of specific items, I see at the bottom, shift of planning functions to capital. Is that something that's been vetted closely?
That's something that we are proposing, and we're still putting the finishing touches on. So the concept is the planning department, typically an operating department, some of their core efforts to develop long-range plans that that develop our CLRP and our CIP plan could be attributed solely to capital costs. But we are still putting the finishing touches.
Yeah, that's
on that.
One I'd like to see the accounting rationale on. It's a very much a close call.
Good. Yes, you're right. You're right.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Ms. Kissel, in the second part of the thing, FY 2012 proposed budget changes from the November forecast, there's a revenue adjustment that's showing a negative 20.5. Is that a number that may change depending on how revenues work for this year, or is that a fixed number?
That number is the initial revenue assessment that we've made in the proposed budget. So we've taken down our estimates on revenue by $20.5 million.
Okay.
But you'll see that analysis will come to the committee, and there's always a big discussion on that because we look at our trend, and when we make this budget, we're really looking at the first quarter, which is really not enough. And so when we take the second quarter into consideration, we could possibly see a trend that may go up. We look at elasticities. So we'll have that discussion in April.
Okay, thanks.
So
just a moment, Mr. Acosta.
Yes, I just had a quick question getting back to the capital or shifting of some of the functions of capital. What functions or what capital projects are we going to defer in order to cover the shift? Or is that something that you'll present at the capital budget discussion?
That's something that we've included in the budget book that you have already. We haven't highlighted the list of deferral projects, but we've vetted it internally, and we've moved projects to the out years that could be moved to the out years. I don't have necessarily a specific list for that, but could.
And the projects don't deal that we've deferred aren't going to affect our safety programs or
safety is not affected.
Programs.
Safety has been held at the top, and none of those projects would have been deferred as a result of this action.
Thank you.
Actually, as I look at the numbers, as I remember them, we shifted, it looks like, roughly $30 million of mostly personnel expense from operating to capital. And then we also took the action in this proposal to get rid of preventive maintenance, which shifts $30 million from capital to operating, so the two balance.
That's correct.
We've essentially paid for that adjustment for preventive maintenance of getting rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Provided that we do get rid of it.
Provided that we do get rid of it. But as proposed, that's what's going on here. So there effectively is no real effect on the capital program because we're now moving back into operating preventive maintenance that should be in operating. Mm-hmm. Can be in capital, but should be in operating.
On page 19, so this chart actually shows the specific cost reductions, and I wanted to go through them again. And then it talks about the implementing the structural changes. So in totality, if you add all these numbers up, it comes to the $74 million of structural changes that we're taking and the elimination of cost. And the two first bullets are the overhaul shops we've identified that extend the useful life of assets, and that would include the capitalization of those costs, the health independent eligibility audit that we're currently in process of implementing throughout the authority, the MTPD better resource development deployment, actually, and this is not taking more police off the system. It's really actually Chief Taborn looking at how to effectively use more civilians where he currently has officers. So it's effectively utilizing his resource in a better manner. We have fuel and propulsion savings. This is propulsion power and energy, diesel. A lot of it is propulsion power. We pay about 11 cents a kilowatt hour. We hedge a lot of this. We've probably already hedged 40% of our propulsion power for next year. And really what that does is it sort of locks in your budget levels. It's not a derivative. It's really just a very safety conservative measure to ensure that your costs are going to be maintained. We've looked at the reduction in parking, and this I expressed last month was the effective use of technology, where we've actually implemented debit credit card readers, and we'll have all of them implemented by the end of this year so that we can actually eliminate a lot of the manpower that we currently have at our parking lots. We'll have a centralized location where if a customer doesn't have a smart trip card to exit the lot or they do not have a debit and credit card, we're able to have a push-button mechanism where we can actually lift the gate and let that person out at a central location. That eliminates a lot of the labor-intensive manpower that we currently have at our lots now, and it's effective use of technology. We've also looked at reduction in support services. This goes to things that we should be looking at all the time, reduction in travel, reduction in printing, reduction in business office expenses. It's basically belt tightening again across the board and eliminating things that we can do without. The bus and rail cost change.
A question on that?
Yes.
Is it truly eliminating things and you've chosen and can identify that you'll be doing without? What always worries me is across the board cuts that you don't know where they're being hit. But if you know what you're not going to be doing and are comfortable with that, very much support it.
Yes, we do know what we can live without. We do know that it won't impact our service. And the big change that we're making this year, which we have never had here, is what I call commitment control in our systems. So as a result, in our operating budget now, we have our system that we can overrun expenses, and they're not controlled by a system. And right now, because we're integrating a lot of our systems, we're going to pick big categories, mostly in the non-personnel side. We're going to not do it on the personnel side because we always want to pay people. But on the non-personnel side, we're going to control those expenses. So if you don't have a budget for it and you initiate a PO and there's no funding available, it will never be impact. It'll never go through the system. And that's a very good control and process that we're putting in place starting July 1. The bus and rail cost changes of $1.9 million, these are good changes that are happening, again, as a result of systems integrations that we're doing. $1 million and maybe more as a result of some of the work that we're doing on our Trapeze scheduling system. They're integrating that system. Jack Requa is heading that project. And as a result, we'll be able to better schedule our bus operators more efficiently. And we'll, as a result, get $1 million out of cost out of that effective use of that system. There are other changes actually in bus two, about $500,000, where they looked at using fewer strategic buses. Currently, right now, we have spare buses in the event that we have a bus that's out of service. We always have spare buses ready to move people. They've looked at that, and with the scheduling efficiencies, buses determined that they could actually get some more efficiencies out of the spare buses. Still have spare buses to make sure people are moved effectively, but there's a reduction that we can take there. The fringe benefit savings, probably about two-thirds of the cost that you see here, the adjustment downward, is due to pension, and then another third is due to health reduction. So What happens typically is we get our actuarial reports after we've done a proposed budget, and as a result of those reports, we're able to actually take some dollars down because the market's performing better, the pensions are performing better, and we have lower costs in health care. The grant-funded positions, this is actually a pure reduction because we have operating costs that can be funded by a dedicated grant, 100%, so it actually saves the operating cost. Track systems and vehicle are, again, capital projects that are moved over to capital. And then the overhead and allocation are primarily due to this is the impact of having a larger capital program. So this year we have an $844 million capital program. And what happens is every one of the indirect support offices or administrative offices, most of 85% of their operating costs hits operating costs. 15% of the work that those people do gets allocated to capital because they support the capital projects in one form or another. And because you have a larger capital program than you did last year we had a $500 or $600 million program. Now when your program is larger, more costs are going to be allocated over to support a larger program. And that's what that change is.
So this adds to the other items that are now being transferred to capital.
It's not necessarily a transfer. It's just a mechanism.
Paid for out of.
It would be paid for.
Paid for out of. So the number of $30 million Mr. Benjamin spoke of is probably closer to 40.
We'd have to take a look at it because the methodology has not changed.
Right. No, I'm not saying it's changed.
But the dollars get changed.
$40 million of the reductions that are being proposed here are things that we'll still be doing, but we'll be charging to the capital program.
That's correct.
Actually, you can see that $40 million in another page.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Downs.
Yes.
Just for clarification, the fringe benefit rate adjustment for the operating budget is operating funds alone, the positions that were transferred to capital, their fringe is now capital?
Would be in capital, that's correct.
It won't show up here. So how much of the fringe benefit rate adjustment total is happening?
You want to look at operating and capital, what the fringe rate adjustment is.
Yes.
I'd have to get back to you. I don't have that information.
It's all money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
It's not an accurate picture to show a $1 million variant or $1 million adjustment between 11 and 12 for fringe benefits. I know it has a little asterisk that says operating.
Right, right. We'll get
that. The problem is the growth in fringe over the last 3 years from 09 to proposed 12 is still well over 20%, it looks like. And that's a pretty healthy growth compared to the participating jurisdictions in fringe cost. Maybe it'd be helpful to look at comparisons about fringe rates in comparison with the participating jurisdictions.
Mr. Downs, the issue that you're bringing up is one that we've looked at very carefully in the last couple of years. The largest single contributor is the performance of the market and how that affects our contributions to pensions. And that's been the driver, unfortunately, and one that we have very, very little control over. Ms. Porter.
I just wanted to ask a question about the MTPD grant-funded positions. You said that was grant funding for things that we would otherwise be paying out of the budget. So the grants don't actually fund additional positions, or are they additional positions?
They are. This specific grant is for was awarded for anti-terrorism. And the headcount associated with that was an additional 10 FTEs that are strictly funded by that grant.
But were those people we already had that were now grant funded, or do we add 10 people?
I'd have to get back to you. I think the chief is using a combination. There may be some new folks, and then he's probably looking at his current staff moving into those positions.
Ms. Kissel, at the time that that was approved, he said he was adding 10 people.
Well, chief is right here, so. Yep.
Good morning. Those anti-terrorism represents 18 officers. There's some monies that speak to reimbursements for K-9, also a bomb liaison, so it totals about 1.9.
All right, but the 18 people, are those all of them new, or did some of them?
They're new positions.
So there's 18 additional people that you didn't have before?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. That was the question. I appreciate it.
If you didn't have before, how can it be a reduction in the budget?
This is a crosswalk between a forecast that we provided to the board in November, which was an early look at what our expenditures would be, and at that time, the forecast had included these positions in the operating. So we're saying that this is now moved.
New positions, but in
correct, and that's the difficulty in crosswalking from an earlier forecast to the proposed budget.
So what we're saying is all of those positions and their costs are included in the operating budget, but we have a revenue that covers it, therefore it doesn't have an effect on subsidy? Or are the costs not included?
No, this is not. It will not have an effect on subsidy.
But because the costs, the positions and their costs are included.
They're all included, that's correct.
And so this is telling us what's it going to do to us in terms of subsidy. Is that right? Okay.
As I understand it, in the forecast, the costs were there, but the revenues were not.
Right, and so they're now taking those back out.
So there are new, and they're also paid for.
Though really the costs will be there, they're just being covered by revenues, is what we're saying, by non-passenger revenues.
On the fringe question, we will get back to you on a total complete picture of fringe. I think it's a fair point. And again, I believe this actually is bridging the four. It doesn't show the right picture because it's looking at forecasted budget. And so we will get back to you on that specifically.
When you do get back, I think it would be useful as well to look at those fringe obligations we have that we are not funding and what some of the long-term implications are of that.
Okay. Mr.
Chair. Ms. Hutchins.
I also think when you get back that we have our budget book, and to me it's so important that for me to keep up with it is to look at the budget and see how it's defined there. And I'd like to see how we have differentiated it in the budget directly. I think this is a bit out of context if we don't see the entire piece as it's defined there.
Ms. Hines, did you have a question?
I actually did. Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. When you get back to us on fringe benefit, I know we've gotten a memo on the health verification audit that's this $3.3 million is anticipated savings based on that audit performs. It's part of fringe, so if you could kind of put that all together for us, I think that would be useful. And then there really are kind of three things, as I listen to you, Ms. Kissel, that in the middle of this that have the potential to impact how our riders or we perceive service, if you will, the parking contract, the reduction in support services, and then the bus and rail cost changes. And I would appreciate having you all provide us information from your perspective about how those will actually work.
Okay.
I imagine I'm stuck out in a parking lot and the gate won't go up, or my debit card doesn't come back out, and do I have to, you know, what do I, it's all those kinds of questions that I have relative to that one. And on the others, I just don't quite understand what the changes might be. So
we can definitely do that. We've actually, as we initiated the debit credit card readers at some of the lanes already, we've prepared a very big communication plan, you know, to inform customers. But as we go to this next level, where now you don't have a manned station, it is going to be very important in order to communicate how that's going to work. So we'll show that to the
right, and I am mindful that we've got parking lot revenue falling, and so we don't want to do something here that makes it even more complex.
Just to finish this chart, actually, casualty and liability, again, this is from a forecast perspective, we've assumed more of a premium in our property and liability insurance. And then where we are today in January, we have actuarials that show that reduction. We reserved, if you recall, a higher level in our reserve since we're self-insured on property and liability as a result of the Red Line incident. And as a result, this year in FY12, those reserves can come down, basically. And that's what that savings is looking like. And then the planning and functions to capital, we will actually get in more detail on what that looks like. So on the next chart, this actually shows the high-level perspective, or actually it shows the year-to-year trends. I have 2009 actuals, 10 actuals, the budget, and then we have the proposed budget and what the changes are. From a high-level perspective, I'll take this from a high level and then we'll get into some of the details. There are three things to look at. The total personnel costs are relatively flat, and I'll come back to the reasons for that in a moment, and they're due to some of the shifts that we talked about in capital, and then there's some increases that are happening as well. When you look at the two of them in totality, it looks like you have a flat year-to-year trend on personnel costs. The second thing is, well, in our non-personnel costs, we also have some personnel costs that are growing, or non-personnel costs that are growing, and some that are have offsetting reductions. But in totality, we have this, this non-personnel cost decreased, if you will, by minus 2%, which is good. And then the third overall statement I'll make on this is that in totality, you really look like you have a proposed budget that is relatively flat on the expenditure side year to year. The increase that you're seeing is the resetting the levels of preventative maintenance back to the $30 million levels versus where we are now at $60 million. And that's where you see you have a 2% increase in totality. So let's go back to the personnel costs.
Ms. Kissel, if I may stop you for a moment.
Sure.
We have a blue sheet in our books which implies a change from our previous information. When you have that many numbers, it's hard to find the change.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's the bold number on the bottom.
It's in bold.
32.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should box it or circle it because I know it's hard to see on the bulge on the blue sheet. And we will do that next time. Thank you. So personnel costs, operating salaries and wages are increase. There are some increases and offsetting decreases, and I'll take you through them. The increases that you don't see here are the contractual obligations in our union contracts, and that's an increase of about 28 or $29 million. There's also an increase, and I'm taking personnel costs in total, of almost $9 million in overtime that we had addressed to the committee in the past, where we had vacancies because of a freeze on bus hires. We had vacancies, and as a result of that, we actually were way behind in filling bus positions, and so we're actually providing the same level of service with now overtime. We have a plan in place to reduce the vacancies on our bus operators. We have to train them, CDL licensees. There's a lot of recruitment activities that go on with regard to that, and we expect to be at steady state levels in a 12-month period. But as a result of that, you're going to see an increase in overtime, which we're going to manage in our budget for FY12. The sure. offsetting decrease.
Good question. With respect to that. As I understand now, this is a bow wave of a phenomenon that has already occurred. We have the vacancies, and you're projecting that they will continue to impact overtime all the way through next year, or at least well into next year.
Into the year.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we sign up for this in the budget, I would be interested in any other alternatives that could speed up hiring and avoid paying unnecessary overtime.
And Mr. Downs?
I also noticed that there's a reduction of 9 positions in HR with assurances that none of those vacancies in HR in any way impact both the recruitment and training and development of the vacancies that are causing the overtime.
They're not. They're actually the vacancies that you see there. The elimination is we've eliminated our internship program, and the internship program is reducing the HR. but they will not affect this recruitment program. The recruitment program that we've established is, we can give you a detailed level what that looks like, but we can give you alternatives potentially to speed that up. We'd have to talk to our chief HR.
They're cheaper than paying the overtime, we should consider them.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, then what were the interns doing?
We have an internship program, a summer internship program, that they're deployed throughout the departments.
And the HR department?
They're actually...
Okay, so they're assigned to other departments.
They're assigned to other departments. They're assigned to operations. They're assigned to whatever, but they're centralized in HR.
Okay, because interns that I've always had, I put them to work, so...
Well, yeah, I had one this year, and he doesn't want to come back because he worked too much. But Dave Kubicek has a lot of interns, you know, in our operations department. We try to get as many. We had a lot. Last year we had 25. This reduction you see is 6. But we try to maintain that. A lot of the recruitment, just to let you know, that it's a great vehicle to recruit. I mean, we get a lot of Virginia Tech students. We get a lot of students from the district and Maryland colleges, and it's really a great way to get some young talent into our system. So it's a tough program to cut, but.
Mr. Chairman, one Mr. Downs. Last item. Is there a cooperative working relationship between, say, the district's Department of Employment Services and the community college about recruitment and training for intake positions at the bus driver and rail operator level?
Yes, we are very linked through the district employment services, as well as I think it's our chief HR officer went over to meet with Mayor Gray and a forum that he had to actually talk specifically about that. And as a result of some of those programs and partnerships that we've had just recently, we've actually surpassed the last 2 months of our training program. We have a class that we deploy of 30 bus drivers we train a month. We've actually met a 40 class training class over the last 2 months. So those are being very effective, and we're continuing that.
Mr. McKay.
On that same subject, I know it's not real germane to hear, but of course we had a whole presentation on the shortage issue and the need to hire consultants to get bus operators in. Is what you just said catching us up to where we need to be, or is there still a deficit there that we need to be aware
of? It's catching us up to where we need to be. When we brought to the board a recruitment item that wanted to spend about $500,000, I can't recall the exact number, it was denied. And what we put in place was an internal recruitment workforce to actually aggressively pursue this issue. So this is the program that I'm speaking about now.
It'll take another year or so. You get fully
12 months.
Out.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
So let me explain the offsetting. I think I was talking about personnel costs. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about, okay, so we had personnel costs. So we have increases and decreases. The increases are about $30 million or $29 million in collective bargaining agreements, which we're contractually committed to include. And as you know, those contracts, one of the major contracts is in arbitration or at the court level. And so we reserved the arbitration position in order to be conservative. The offsetting, the decrease is the cost, labor costs that we've shifted over to capital, appropriately so. And as a result, that's why you see an $11 million increase in total personnel costs year to year. There's been puts and takes on both.
So if we were to compare the chart 2 pages before, where we have $43.7 million in increases in labor and fringes, and an additional 7.3 in overtime, which presumably is also labor and fringes, mm-hmm. we come up with a total of $51 million in increases for personnel. Is that right? And then on the next chart, the one you have up now, we see only $11 million in increases, and you're saying, this brings us back to Mr. Downey's number, that $40 million is the structural changes that are scattered elsewhere throughout this budget.
That's correct.
Or any other change.
Any other change, right. So that then leads us to the question of, okay, under salaries you have a $2 million net increase. Does that say that we are increasing, we're giving cost of living increases, we are increasing the staff? What are we increasing?
Those actually are an assumption that we made in the proposed budget that deals specifically with salary equity adjustments. And I'll give you an example, which we recently had with escalators and elevators. So we had a program, and I think one of the audit assessments, the assessment that we had on that program, identified that we had salary compression issues, which was actually hampering some of the efficiency of that program. And when you have those things, you have that salary compression issue, it leads to other specific problems in performing core services. So what we've assumed in here is adjusting salary equity adjustments throughout the year where appropriate, and that's what that is.
So what you're saying is we are not talking about cost of living increases for our professional staff?
No.
Our non-represented staff. So the thing that's included in here is taking care of those sort of weird situations that suddenly occur where somebody might be paid substantially less than somebody that they're supervising.
Yes.
And the rest is all union contract-driven numbers?
Yes, that's correct. We have actually, and I mentioned it last month, we have a study that's the Hay Group is doing for us on this issue, and they're coming back to report to the CEO later this month on the results of that assessment. And they're specifically looking at salary administration, and one of the big components is the salary compression issue that we have. So
what we're saying is there are no substantial salary or wage increases other than those that are included in contracts, including the ones that are currently in dispute in the courts.
That's correct.
Which then raises the question of newspaper reports that say that we are increasing people's salaries, that the average salary has gone up, and this is your opportunity to explain why that isn't the case.
Well, okay, try to think which newspaper report that was, but
right behind you.
Okay. If I recall, what we have in our FY11 budget in terms of average salary, and then what we're proposing for FY12, there's a 3% increase, and that is specifically attributed to the collective bargaining agreements that we have. I believe that the report was talking about 2010 levels, where you had a jump that appeared that it looked like it was a 6,000 or maybe over 6,000, 6%, thank you, increase in average salary over year to year. And when we looked into that, it was mostly, if not all, attributed to the overtime that we had in operations. So the overtime is a significant factor in looking at average salary at any one point. And so any program that we look at, our bus recruitment program, is dialed in to manage that overtime because it's not in our best interest to continue operation.
Yeah. Does that overtime go into the pension base?
Is the overtime going to the pension base?
Can I answer that one for you?
Can you answer that for me?
if it is a union person in the last 3 years, it does.
Thank you.
For a non-represented employee, it does not.
No, that's correct. Right. I was thinking about the union.
And it's only in their last 3 years. Any other union person that doesn't go
But if their last three include a lot of overtime, we'll then be paying for that overtime for the next 30 years.
Well, and they also have seniority, so they have first choice on the overtime. So we're in a box there relative to how it works. I'm still trying to clarify in my mind. You use the word salaries. I presume you mean by that really wages.
Wages,
because you said it's union contract-driven numbers. Is there anything in there other than union contract-driven numbers that drive this up, the 3% that you're talking about?
I mean, if you look at our employee population of 11,000, 90% of it is union. So that's going to drive the number up. And so there's other things that are in there, fringe, and I think in our budget book we have a highlighted page that indicates the categories. But the predominant increase is collective bargaining agreements. And I will make a note, a change on what I said earlier. The overtime, when we looked at it, that impacted the average wage was primarily due to track and infrastructure work that we had. So this goes to the fact that we have not the steady state of good repair, that we have you know, ignored, and actually there's been a push to move that forward, and that's where we're seeing some of the overtime.
This is the operating portion of that, the rest of which is in capital, which then raises the other part of what I thought you were going to talk about, which is the analysis of salaries and wages included both operating and capital.
That's
was
correct.
Capital any contributor to that increase?
Capital meaning in what terms?
The people who were paid out of the capital funds, has that in any way contributed to the average increase in salaries and wages, which were pointed out? Because that was a total comparison, both
budgets.
That was
a total comparison, yes.
And was the capital part of that increase as you saw it?
I look at the increase in terms of elements that drive it. So when you say capital, I'm not sure what you're asking me, actually.
I guess one of the things that's happening is we are hiring people for capital. We're expanding
that's
our
correct.
Staff.
Right.
Who are probably more highly paid than the average.
Oh, okay.
That's basically
and who
the
may
I'm
work
asking.
Overtime hours.
There's a component to that, but I don't know what it is, and we can take a look at it. But the predominant is agreements, collective bargaining agreements, step increases that we are obligated to make on a regular basis, which average about 1.5-2%. And overtime, which I discussed, those are the two primary drivers. Yes, are there capital hires, engineers that we're hiring in order to deploy our major program? And do they have a slightly higher salary? Yes, that's true. Is it a major driving factor? Probably not.
So the two major factors that you're telling us are 1.5% steps that our union employees get anyway.
That's correct.
Regardless of how the court case comes out.
Regardless.
Another 3% that we have to write budget right now, but that may or may not be expended depending upon the results of the court case?
It depends on the court case. That's correct.
Okay.
And that should be.
So that totals about 4-5% that we're looking at right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Hutchins.
I just wanted to know, because when you started off, you used the term equity, and I assume what you were saying there is that it's a typical reclassification of something. That is, Ms. Hines is sitting here doing a job, and I come in and I ask, or you, by market give, you have to change her salary or reflect that in that classification of it?
That's correct.
Is that the – and in that, you're saying that the labor contract has one set, but in the larger other general employee group, the same is occurring.
What happens is, and you're on the right point, because the labor contracts have built-in increases, these step increases. Mm-hmm. And your non-rep population, and both board members are working side by side, you're a collective bargaining worker and you're not, and when we freeze COLAs, we don't have COLAs, we don't have performance increases, you don't have any of those year to year, your salary actually starts to decrease over time. And what happens is you have this inequity. And when you have that inequity and two people doing the same type of job and skill set, it becomes a problem.
And it is triggered naturally. That is,
yes.
You are required to go back and look at those?
Yes. Okay. We're not required. Our policy actually indicates that we may or may not. So it's not a requirement that this increase can be made. It's just that they're dealt with by a case-by-case basis by the CEO.
An example of it was with the elevators and escalators. What we found is because of the compression issues, supervisors are dropping back into the union ranks. That's a perfect example of it.
Mr. Downs, you had a question?
It's about the $35 million wage reserve. First, is that operating and capital, or is that an operating only?
It's the operating portion only.
It would be interesting to see the total combined. The other is that I'm at a disadvantage in terms of probably previous board briefings about both the legal and labor negotiation strategy assumptions behind the conservative estimate that you say is represented by the $35 million. And at some point before we get further into the budget about this item, it would, I think, be appropriate to have an appropriate briefing for at least the new board members to get caught up.
And I believe that is happening as we do the orientation sessions with the new board members. That's on the agenda.
Any other questions? Please proceed.
Okay. So when we move to the non-personnel costs, the total non-personnel costs, you see a decrease of 2%. And I'll talk about there's some increases and then there's some decreases. The paratransit one, which we'll go to first, is an increase of $13 million year over year. That is right now is a placeholder where we have now. I know Christian Kent is looking at coming back to the board in March, and potentially that number could decrease, depending upon how they review the existing contracts that they have that currently provide this level of service. So that is what I have now, other than it's mostly contract driven. The cost that you see here, the year-over-year cost, it's not necessarily ridership driven. The ridership and the policies that the committee and the board have put in place have actually been very effective, and some of that ridership is being slower growth is happening in Metro Access. So the costs that you see here are specifically contract costs as a result of a six-year contract that we're approaching the end of.
Certainly those of us who contribute very substantially to our paratransit services are concerned about the fact that at a time when we're getting about 3 to 4% increases in ridership, we're looking at potentially 12% increases in subsidy. And there's got to be some way to bring those numbers closer. So we will anxiously be looking at this. And the answer we keep getting when we say, well, how come ridership isn't going up as fast as costs, is it's in the base part of the contract. And the question is, why did we come up with a contract where the base has got to be accelerating at a much, much higher rate than the number of riders? And what's in this contract anyway?
And I believe Christian will be able to provide the board with that level of detail in March. Like I said, it's a six-year contract that was negotiated 6 years ago. So when you're at the end of a contract, there may be escalating costs, and I'll leave that to him to discuss with the board in March. But the point here is that the $13 million that you see here is hopefully a conservative number and can be brought down based upon the work that Christian does in that regard.
We will certainly await that discussion, and focus on those disparities would be greatly appreciated. Mr. Downs, are you ready to say something here? No? Yes.
Only that if the board has taken all of the tough steps, both about reducing the envelope of service for access and increased the rates, it is unacceptable to have an outcome that the public continues to pay an accelerating cost for that after the changes are being borne by the riders of access, that the public continues to have a subsidy rate that does not reflect that. It's an unacceptable answer that, well, it's baked into the contract. Well, we negotiated that contract, and we have to have lessons learned about how we do this in the future if we're going to continue to take steps that reduce the cost of the service.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. That was a stronger way of saying it. Ms. Hudgens.
I hate to defer the discussion moving on, but I think when Mr. Kent comes back, I think what I hear and would like to see is, and I think the fare is about $4 to $5 that is actually the fare side of this. And so as if we could see where that was the last time and where this now contract piece pushes us, because, again, if we were looking at other services, we would see a variance there as to what the contribution was relative to the cost. And here you're saying we're not seeing my variances.
They're disconnected, but right. I'm sure Mr. Kent will provide that. So.
Pricing, no matter what.
Okay. The offsetting decrease you see is in materials and supplies. And some of this is certainly due to the fact that this is the parts component where you're actually capitalizing parts. So you're moving parts which extend the life cycle of an asset, and you're moving it over to the capital. And to your question, Mr. Downey, which I know you will ask me, is we will that also does impact the capital budget. We've assumed that already in our capital budget. But these are actually structural changes that we should have made, and those are good changes to make. The other part of that is actually streamlining our procurement activities. It's been it's taken this year, a long year, to actually make that happen. And you'll see some of the fruits of that labor by FY12. And it means taking requirements contracts that we've typically had, which purchase things, you know, one by one, and putting in place bus and rail master contracts, negotiated up front. You get the benefit of, you know, discounts and pricing up front, things like paying instead of, you know, paying through the system, electronic payments and things like that. These are things that we have in place now, and we'll see the benefits of that streamlining in FY12. And hopefully a lower stock outage on parts. So, on the fuel and propulsion, again, that's just our use of diesel and power. And, of course, we hedge those contracts, and we actually benefit from that hedge position. And then the other piece is casualty and labor. As I said again, this is primarily not a decrease in the premiums that you're paying in your insurance, property, and liability. It's really the fact that I can take my reserves down. Where we had higher reserves because of the incident in the Red Line, FY12, I don't expect that, so we're taking those reserves down, and that's a benefit to the operating budget. And those are the big drivers, actually, in the non-personnel cost. When you get to the bottom line, the net expense looks like it's increased by 2.3%, but that's because the recommended budget is taking preventive maintenance down to the $30 million level versus the 60, and that's where you see the biggest change.
Carol, could you bridge for me the $32 million, which it now says as opposed to two, at the bottom of this to the $74 million increase in subsidy requirement?
Yes, great question.
If
you see that your expenses are really relatively staying flat year to year, what's driving the $72 million subsidy increase? And what's driving that are probably three main things. The one thing is the $30 million of preventative maintenance that we did last year. So that's $30 million that you're going to give back.
Yeah.
The second item is the negative $16 million or $16.4 million of the loss that we had last year, which we're carrying over to in FY12. And then the third item primarily is the $25 million in reduction in ridership revenue, which we have yet to talk about, but we will in April. And then there's $2 million in the expenses, but those are the three main drivers that make up your $72 million subsidy.
Thank you.
So the next chart. I'm going to skip these charts, but they're great charts. They show really basically, you know, predominant expenses, you know, what makes up your budget. Fringes, wages, and salaries. You can see the breakout here. And then on the next chart, the next pie chart, just gives you a big picture on the big drivers of cost to our budget, paratransit, fuel and power, services, and materials and supplies that run our core service. And if you skip this chart, and I'm going to skip these charts because I've pretty much already talked about it on the number chart, but if you can go to the next chart, which talks about the next one after this, headcount. So we've had a lot of questions on headcount recently, actually, and I wanted to address it here for the board, for the committee. So the headcount that you see here, if you look at 10 headcount, those are actual, and then capital, and then the total. 11, this is what's in our current budget now, and then you look at the proposed. And basically, the way I look at this, most of your headcount is increasing in capital. And if you have a capital budget, if you look at budget to budget, Metro's capital budget is increasing by almost 50%. You're going from a $600 million budget to an $844 million budget that we have right now. We're ramping up to that even for next year, which means that you have to ramp up your force account labor to effectually implement that budget. And in order to do that, you need people. And so that is really the net that you see there, the biggest increase, which is the 263. It's capital, headcount to do the major capital programs that Jack, Dave, technology programs that we have in place, or we'll have in place in our CIP.
So basically what's happened is several years ago, I guess about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we started a process of moving away from capital programs and reducing our capital headcount quite low,
Yes.
And we are now reversing that and saying we have before us a major replacement and rehabilitation program that we have got to carry out, and we are now expending at a rate that's much higher. We got to bring that kind of management staff back into the organization.
Right, and people as well. I mean,
and operating, and people who are actually doing the work.
Yeah, and people who are doing the work.
People who are doing work.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McKay.
Along those lines, would it be possible for you to give us the percent of these positions that are actually filled or were filled for FY 2010 and FY 2011?
We have a head count here.
Doesn't necessarily mean that there are people in these positions.
That's
correct. I'd just like to know how we're doing year to year in filling these positions.
Right. We can provide that. I will say, just from memory, and we'll get you the detail, but on average, we probably run a 2 or 3% vacancy rate. But I will provide the detail. Do you want it by department or?
I just want it in operating and capital.
Operating and capital. Yeah. Okay, that's fine. We can do that. We'll provide that.
Mr. Benjamin.
Ms. Heitz.
Ms. Kissel, I'm a little confused because we approved these positions being added for the Dulles Metro project.
Yes.
And in that resolution, we talked about increasing the headcount from 11,077 to 11,089 in FY 2011.
Right.
And we got 10,974 showing here. And so I'm trying to understand, is some of that increase between 11 and 12 proposed already built in here, or what's actually going on?
Yeah, the FY 2011 is our adopted budget.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And so that's the number, that's the difference. And as the board has, what I should show here is a column, as you appropriately have indicated, the amended budget, so that it shows all of the headcount changes that the committee has made over the last few months. There's been more that we've made in September that are associated all with capital projects, and we can show that.
I think that's important as people look at that change from the 600 to the 1,000
yes.
in capital, because we are doing this incrementally.
We're ramping up,
and to not show that makes it look like this huge
yes.
Change. Okay. The other thing that I would ask for in this is also a point that was made during the Dulles conversation is some of these are fully reimbursable.
That's correct.
And so breaking out what the operating fund itself has to bear, the subsidy has to bear, mm-hmm. from what is being paid for another way. Mm-hmm. Would for me be a helpful way to understand
that.
What's going on as
well.
So we'll
break it out, operating capital, we'll look at vacancy, operating capital, and we'll also look at the amended headcount going forward to show the ramp up, and then we'll show what's reimbursable and what's actually would be impacted by the subsidy. I think that would be a good,
great,
yeah, we can do that.
Thank you.
And let me suggest that when you've had a whole bunch of requests here, which I hope we're carefully recording.
We're recording in many different ways.
But that we not do these through a series of memos that go to the board, but that we, in fact, have a discussion of these in public session, meaning probably at the time that we do revenues 2 months from now. If you want to do it during capital, depending on how much time we've got, we might be able to do it then. But let's make sure that we have a discussion of it, not just,
yeah.
Here's a memo, that's the answer.
I think we'd like to do it because we have the information, and we attempt to do it for the March committee, if that's okay.
Okay.
And we'll combine that with the capital. So.
Chairman, I appreciate getting the memo as well.
We can do that as well.
We want to be prepared, but we also want to have a public discussion on it.
We will do both. So the next chart, so I wanted to talk a little bit about this because we showed it last month.
Can I stop you before you get into this?
Oh, yes.
For a moment.
Sure.
First of all, I want to compliment Mr. Sorrells and you, Ms. Kissel, and the staff in putting together what I think is one of the tightest budgets I've seen in my years here on the board, certainly not the years that I was putting them together.
Of course not.
Now, you did a really, really good job. You took all the obvious targets away from us. You know, we're down to the really difficult things to try to deal with, and I think that's what you're putting in front of us now, is a series of assumptions and a series of issues that are true policy issues that we as a board have got to deal with, because you've done such a good job on cleaning up the rest of it. There aren't very many things we can do there to try and cut. And we are in the difficult situation right now that with something in the range of a $75 million potential increase in subsidies and the local jurisdictions, many of them struggling with their own budgets, we've got to responsibly look at which of these things, none of which we want to do, are we in a position where we might have to do them. Mm-hmm. And I think as we proceed, that's a context in which we ought to be looking at these.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Downey.
Yeah, looking at these, I think we should keep in mind much of our business is demand-driven. We have rush hour people. We have to meet that. All of these are policy-driven decisions about levels of service, and we have to address them in that fashion.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, these are policy service. These are things where we're maintaining a service not because enormous numbers of people want to do it, but because we feel that there's some other reason to provide the service. Mr. Downs.
I mentioned to the general manager's CEO that I would like to see an analysis of the constraints on the capital program that are imposed by the 3 a.m. service. We have terrible conflicts about operating our availability and track availability for this largest capital program that we've ever undertaken. And I think it is a legitimate question for the board to address in light of Mr. Downey's reaffirmation that some of these are policy driven. And this is a policy, I think, that potentially constrains our ability to deliver the rail program that we're all looking for. So I look forward to part of that discussion going forward.
If I could ask just one semantic question. I don't understand why headway widening costs us money. Aren't we narrowing the headways from what they might otherwise be, and that costs us money?
That's just the cost of what the off-peak rail headway widening is currently.
But we don't widen the headway, you run fewer trains. We're going tighter headways. As opposed to having 15 minutes, we make a policy call that they be 10 minutes. That's not a wider headway, that's a lessened headway. Right. Increased frequency of service.
So
would you like to go through these very
quickly?
I don't know what each one is. I'm sorry. Mr. Costa.
Just to follow up on this discussion about policy, discussions about the service levels that we're providing. I mean, I think the other question is what standards are we going to use to make these decisions? Because obviously we have equity issues, coverage issues, productivity and efficiency issues, as well as how it affects our capital service. So I think before we go into a discussion of that, I think we should have some way to organize our discussion so we can treat each of these things fairly, knowing that there are various constituents that will be affected by this. And I think I think before we get into a debate about this, that would be a helpful thing to do.
And I will say that I think everything's been said on these two charts, actually, better than I could say it. But your last comment is very appropriate, because the point that we wanted to make on this chart is there are productivity impacts in continuing this type of level of service. And Dave Kubicek is looking at that and might be able to just talk a little bit about, you know, what some of those productivity impacts are currently that we're looking at. But I agree there should be some standards.
We have been reviewing and working very closely with Carol and everybody on this, and we're trying to figure out what's the best way to frame this, the overall impact of what's taking place versus, because there's percentages involved as well as expenditures. But I'll just give you a couple of examples. If we were to shut down early on, or say for instance at 12 o'clock on Friday and Saturday night, basically those amount of hours equate to us adding an eighth day in a seventh day work week. It's that substantial. Then if you were to broadcast that over an entire calendar year, you know, putting aside whenever we have to do early openings for special events and holidays and everything else, we would probably pick up an additional 40 to 45 days of work that could be applied for state of good repair and capital efforts. And the magnitude of that, as we look at that, it's planning. And so when you look at that 40 to 45 days, I mean, realistically, you're adding another month within, you know, basically within the same calendar year or physical year as you work off of that. And we're focusing on, you know, again, it's traction power. It's just all the basic working efforts, but it's also what the customer really experienced in going through. It's acceleration of repair of platforms. It's the acceleration of amenities, you know, in the station, like tile work and elevator escalator work outages and stuff that we can work off of. The other concern and the other big focus is what we've talked about here last month about us communicating with y'all on the looking in the out years with the NTSB recommendations, line segment contracts, train control, everything else. Those are very tangible products and impacts that we're going to have to deal with one way or another. And so from a scheduling standpoint, it would really, you know, help us out. So, and, you know, behind that, we're kind of approaching it from a perspective of trying to equate a burn rate on a monthly basis or versus an hour rate. And I also would say from an efficiency standpoint, I'd like to make this point clear as well. Whenever we sign these big contracts, it could be external services or even our internal services, that we, our internal staff. We pay out basically on an eight-hour window. The more that we are able to get out there to do this work and access it, the more efficient that we actually become, and that accelerates the impact to the, and the reliability of the system. And I do agree with the comment about, you know, our services are really peak-driven, and that's what we've really tried to focus on is AM, you know, PM, naturally those are the big time frames, the off-peak during the day to make sure that we're maintaining within the window, and the late night. But that's just a quick top overview, and there's a lot of other data as we start looking and plugging these dates and how we accelerate this. It gets very complex, but we'll do our best to explain and work.
Mr. McKay.
Yeah, you just gave us a good analysis of if you stopped at midnight. But there's a three-hour window there that we're talking about, and I would assume as you look at each of those hours, just from an efficiency standpoint, you know, they're not equal. In other words, if it was one, if it was two, if it was three. So what might be helpful for us to see is what is the net increase that you're having in each of those scenarios. If it was midnight, if it was one, if it was two, obviously we know what it is at three. But I would assume, you know, this is not an all or nothing, but by the same token, it needs to be substantial enough to reap the type of efficiency rewards that you were just mentioning. So I think a helpful piece of information to get back to us would be do that same analysis for 1 a.m., do that same analysis for 2 a.m. so that we at least know what the range of options are and what the benefits are for each of those.
Yeah, that's very durable. It's from a production rate standpoint, you know, say for instance like insulators, which has been a big issue here, and we've been going through a pretty aggressive campaign. We have an idea of a certain window, how many we can replace or how many feet that we can actually work within that given window. So I think it's pretty realistic that we could extract some functionality work and everything else and equate that on an hour-by-hour basis.
Ms. Hines.
Thanks, Mr. Benjamin. Mr. Kubitschek, if I'm getting an eighth day to my seven-day week, or I'm adding 45 days a year of more work, there have to be personnel costs associated with that. So this is this a net savings? Because if people are working more, I have to pay them more.
For a little bit further clarification on that, we have an existing, you know, staff that is here. If we can only get 2 or 3 hours of work out on the track that is really substantial work, we still have to cover that other 8 hours, and they could be doing work maybe in a yard or at a different facility. But what we're really focusing on is how do we utilize those resources to get out to work on the actual system where everywhere it's very, very visible. So from this perspective, I don't necessarily see it in a staff, you know, impact, at least existing what we have right now, other than if we wanted to accelerate in other areas. but it's just a better utilization of our time and resources.
You're saying that we're paying them the hours anyway.
Yes.
This would allow us to actually get work out of them during those same hours.
Oh, my
That's
goodness.
That's correct.
Are we saying they're not working for the
No, I'm not saying that they're not working.
Okay.
It's just the type of work that we're actually able to execute. You know, whenever we cannot get out on the main line, you know, or say, for instance, we cannot get out on the main line, we'll have the staff doing work in yards or other facilities and amenities. But our real focus is where the customer is being impacted is going to be out there on that main line in the stations, areas that we can really focus at versus, you know, having to kind of work in the back shop environment where a lot of people don't see the impact. You know, the impact is elevator, escalators, it's tile. You know, I'm sure y'all have seen this recent weather. They went through an exchange program probably about 10 to 12 years ago. Well, tile only lasts so long, and if you go around a lot of these above ground substations and stuff, this last winter, I mean, this weather and everything else, we have had a lot of tile that has, you know, been damaged. And then you've seen at Rockville or Tacoma or Shady Grove, we've got new edgers. We've got new material and products and stuff that we're putting in that needs to be replaced now. And then the other positive byproduct of this is that the materials that we'll be putting in that have much better abrasive adhesion, you know, for people that are walking. And we view that we're going to get a long service life, and we won't have a lot of follow-up work like what we're seeing with what's taking place to replace a little bitty 6-inch tile. So that's the tangible on our part, is to be able to get out there and really deliver on products and services that the customer, you know, interacts with versus the systems and stuff that's, you know, not quite as visible. And again, it's for us, it's reliability. The biggest thing is getting on-time performance to improve and making sure that this system runs the way that it should.
I'm sorry. Could I just make another an observation, I guess? I think what Mr. Acosta said is really important. If I know the board had expressed an interest in having hearings, and I think that we should do that. These are choices around these issues that really will impact people. What we have to be sure is when we go out to the public that this is understood. And the other point I would make is, we might not be deciding to eliminate a policy, but we might be deciding to suspend the policy in order to accelerate something that people would experience. And so making this change cuts 6 months or a year off of a timeline is the kind of information that is helpful to me in evaluating whether it's worth the pain of making the change initially. So I think we need to spend a little time figuring out how to frame that up and how to get the right information so people really understand. I mean, our goal is Metro 2.0, right? That's our goal. And how long it's going to take us to get there on some of these things that are absolutely the riders. And we're new, so we don't understand the timelines. But I think that's kind of the way this has to be framed up.
Yes, Hutchins.
Well, maybe it'll all come together in the same question I have. We have the Yellow Line extension to Fort Totten on this list, if I recall, when we had a great discussion years ago about extensions and the criteria and all of that, and I hope that you can bring back for the board what we used or were saying that we wanted to use, so before we found ourselves backed into extensions that suddenly we have a service delivery that has more cost than we had thought or less service than we had programmed, such that we can have people understand how we got there and does it apply still. And I was going to wait until we got to the timetable of schedules, but I think the question about how we talk about this is going to be very important.
If I may follow up on both the comments by Ms. Hines and Ms. Hutchins, one of the things I thought you were looking at relative to the first item on late night service was the possibility of providing either bus or taxi service as an alternative along the rail lines or along those routes, or T teaming up with Sober Ride or somebody like that in order to provide an alternative during that period. To the degree that you have been able to do those analyses and can give us some sense as to whether that is a possible other way to deal with people who need rides late at night, that would be useful to us. The other thing is to clarify, and I think that's another part of where we have to be looking at these. When we say, for instance, off-peak rail headway widening, that's worth $10 million. From what to what generates the $10 million? Yellow Line extension to Port Totten. Are we talking about going back to Mount Vernon? On each of these, can you lay out for us what it is that these dollars are associated with?
We have that. We provided it to the JCC, but we can provide it to the committee.
Can you actually tell us right now so that we have a
good
idea as to what you're talking about?
So widening Saturday headways from 12 to 15 minutes, running 15-minute headways from opening to 9:30, widening Sunday headways from 15 to 20 minutes, and running the 20 minutes headways all day long. And then on the widening the weekend late-night headways from 20 to 30 minutes to midnight to closing. Widening weekday late-evening headways from 20 to 30 minutes between 9:30 p.m. to midnight closing. And widening weekday midday headway from 12 to 15 minutes between 10 and 2, which is a...
So none of these is a lot of minutes. We're talking 3 minutes here and 5 minutes there at the most.
Sometimes it's 30 minutes. Sometimes the headway gets to 30.
The 20 to 30 is...
Oh, right. Yeah. 20 to 30, right. And the Yellow Line extension, that was... Are you talking about going back to Mount Vernon?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And current weekend opening times, instead of 7 a.m., is 1.1 million, 8 a.m.?
That's correct.
1 hour late, yes. That's correct.
Okay. Are the others that you have here, are you going to go through these, or are we finished with these?
Yeah, I wasn't going to go through it in detail other than to make the point that we've associated riders, so you have to take a look at, you know, the average rider that takes the service currently, impact, and then the point that we would look at what Dave Kubicek indicated, which is productivity and utilization, because that is key. And what you had indicated, Ms. Hines, which is actually really framing the issue appropriately for customers so they understand it. So those are things that we will take back and work on.
As you get to on the next page of this, I think many of them are sort of obvious, but how about non-regional service? Are you talking about all non-regional service?
Same question with respect to Saturdays and Sundays. Is this the entire cost of running on Saturday and on Sunday, or...?
This is entire non-regional service, so it's the entire cost, yes.
And on the weekend days, it's also the entire cost of running on a weekend day?
We're looking at weekends for rail?
No, looking at bus.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's correct.
That's the entire day we would run no bus service at all.
Shut down, save $35 million, but maybe there's some room within that.
Yes, and in the appendix, I believe, which we gave to you, we sort of... we break it out even further in detail.
So these are probably options that we're not going to seriously consider, cutting off all regional service after, or cutting all service on Saturdays or Sundays, which says that if we're going to go to any kind of public hearing on this stuff or discussion with the public, we really need to hone these down to recommendations that we're more likely to really seriously consider. Did you want to say something, Ms. Hudgens?
Yes, I hope that we won't. For us to try and make a decision, if we start narrowing our position down before we talk to our public, it kind of changed the framework that you talk to your public on. Surely we could say absolutely not, we won't even consider any of these, but I think what staff has done is tried to provide a framework so that we have something to work in. And I want to believe that the public would want to know, and then we can step back if we want to from what we hear. And I think that goes to the calendar here, where in the calendar it talks about a town meeting or public hearings. I guess what you're saying there, the requirement of a public hearing that would reach the legal criteria for us to have a public hearing. But I would say, at least as Ms. Hine has noted, a town hall meeting or something that, no matter what the requirement is, if we're not bound legally, we should still be talking to the public. I would rather have the framework that the discussion is held in, because it's an informing piece. It's a way of educating our public as to what it is that they buy in the service and we provide them. And doing so, I think, in a much more, I don't want to use the word intelligent way, but a much more informed way helps us in arriving at our decision.
I agree, Ms. Hudgens. My concern is that when you go out to the public and you say, we're considering potentially stopping all Saturday service, or potentially stopping all Sunday service, or potentially stopping all non-regional service, what you get back is testimony that says, no, you can't do that, and we already know that. So what's useful is to give them options that are more within the range of something where they can make a comment that is useful to us. And that's why I sort of look at these things and say, yeah, they're interesting, but as they are, they're not likely to generate very much except panic, and a useless panic in that we're not going to do that anyway.
I guess, Mr. Benjamin, if I could comment, I think some of the questions Mr. McKay asked about, you know, the per hour cost, coupled with the ridership in those kinds of hours, is also really useful information, as well as where are people riding? You know, are people going from the center city out on Saturdays and Sundays? What's actually happening here? So that what the options are become more clear to us as well. And maybe there, as you said, you know, maybe there are these alternatives with late night hours. Well, maybe there's also alternatives in the daytime where, you know, if you cut bus service a little, then you don't cut the headways on Metro, and you think those, you know, these things are interrelated. We recover more costs on Metro than we do on buses. So all of that, I think, if we're going to have an intelligent conversation with our public, then I'm with Mrs. Hudgens, put the whole number out there, but talk about the per hour and talk about, you know, who's riding and all of that stuff too, so people really understand what the choices are before us.
And one of the other choices that's obviously there and reflected in the budget is additional contributions from the jurisdictions. Yeah. If those are not forthcoming, we still have to balance the budget, and these are among the things we have to look at.
Right. Yeah, that's the context in which this whole discussion occurs.
A suggestion I'd like to make, because we have been working with the JCC in order to develop some of the framework that you're talking about, and I think that would be a proper vehicle to use with the JCC input, because we have all the detail that you just described, Ms. Hines. We've looked at it before in past years, and we can obviously refresh and update the metrics on that. But we're committed to working with the JCC to develop that framework and then provide that to the committee as you can use and approve for the framework for any town or public hearing. So.
If you could refresh my memory, when do we have to schedule a public hearing in order to meet the rest of the budget timetable?
The public hearing should occur in March in order to meet the timetable that we have for the approved budget.
Wait a minute. Why would it have to happen in March? If what we really want to get is thoughtful commentary from our public, and meaningful commentary, which means you have to give them some real substantive questions that they can respond to. What happens between March and June that's so critical? I mean, why can't we have more time to be thoughtful about what we ask them?
It's just scheduling. In the past, in the last 2 years that I have been doing this, we always are coming down to the wire, which we may do again, mm-hmm. but it would be preferable to try to have a more planned approach. I do agree we could push it back to early April, you know, in order to make sure, but I would not actually recommend moving past April much to have this dialogue.
Well, I understand if what we're doing is specific route changes and stuff like that. These are more general budget-type questions. Now, they may lead to specific route changes, we may generate specific route changes in the process, but we don't have those kinds of hearings before us at this point.
But if we reduce, say, the services adjusted, there's labor issues, there's pick changes that we have to do, there's scheduling changes. It actually churns a very large system to move, and that system doesn't move very quickly if you're taking actual people out, if you're reducing service, because that's really what we're speaking about here. And so the earlier that you can actually do that, it would be the better. That's
we
all.
Understand, but we also want to have intelligent and meaningful choices for our public to comment upon. Mr. Downs.
I've never been very comfortable with the idea that the needs of the organization supersede the need of the public to have adequate information, to have adequate input into a decision framework that is as significant as this. If the organization needs to struggle with its own processes, I would rather have the organization do that than I would not having a complete story for the public, for our customers, to struggle with about their input into this process. This is too important a set of decisions to bring to the public to not have it be thought out instead of hastily thrown together and have the public try and sort this out. Our job shouldn't be to create confusion and panic among our customers about options that this board is considering. The board ought to be able to help with management to craft meaningful alternatives that are brought to the public in a public hearing process. If that means that we have to take longer to do it, so be it. I think we owe that to our customers and our public. And I wouldn't support, if we're going to be serious about option considerations like modification of some of these parameters, to do that next month. We're not ready for prime time. We haven't even had the kinds of conversations among this board to be able to narrow what we think are options to take to the public. If we're going to be serious, we need to be serious. The board needs to be involved with the CEO and the staff about pricing and ridership impacts so that we can make some informed judgments about what is realistic in our minds about options for the public. We owe that to the customers.
Mr. McKay.
Yeah, along those lines, I just want to be clear, because we were talking about the JCC before, and we spent a lot of time talking about the closure on Friday and Saturday, but not really about all of these. Was your intention to go back to the JCC and give a further explanation on all of these? Because I think that's what the board would like to have, not just on the early closing. So, because I know that they've been apprised of some of these things. I don't think they've dug into the extent that we're now asking that we'd like to have this dug into. So is your intention to go back to them on each of these items with additional information?
That is the intent, yes.
So when would that occur? I'm just trying to think of this in a timeline, because that's kind of a good first step in going back to them to understand some of these impacts and help us understand those. If that's near term, maybe these deadlines can work. But if it's a long period of time before you can get back to them, then we are going to have a challenge with the timeline.
I think the next time, and maybe the JCC can help me out on when the next meeting is. Is it next Friday? 2 weeks? Okay, two weeks. So our intention is to have the information to the JCC mailed out next week, so they're looking at it. And then at that meeting in 2 weeks, have that detailed dialogue to establish the framework that we're speaking about.
Okay, because I do think that's a huge, big, important first step, because there's a lot here. And, you know, I agree with Tom about us working with the general manager and CEO on some of these things, but also realistically, I'd like the JCC to chew on these and give us some feedback on how all of these are impacting us so that we can have a more intelligent conversation about that. So I think it's critical to get to them that date with, you know, much more detailed information on each of these proposals.
Yeah, it would be helpful if we could see that kind of a timeline schedule. And also keep in mind, these changes, if we were to make them, do not have to happen on the 1st of July. If we put them in place in September, we wouldn't save as much money, but we might be able to do a better job.
Which is a very important point. It's more important to do this job right than to try and do it against a schedule that would prevent us from making the right decisions for this region. Any other comments? Mr. Wells.
Just to understand a little better, I know staff highlighted the budget proposal talks about the cost of continuing the Yellow Line extension. Is there a distinction between the Yellow Line extension and the Midday Red Line extension between Grosvenor and Shady Grove? So would staff recommend we examine both equally?
On here, but we will, Mr. Rose, we will put that, we'll add that. We can examine both, yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move ahead to our calendar?
Well, so I think on this calendar, there's a lot of to-dos that I expected to come out of this meeting, which are great. And so what we'll do is we'll modify the calendar to accommodate for the discussion here, include the JCC, the framework, the objective of that, providing information back to the board in a memo format, as well as in a March FA committee. And we'll lay that calendar out in detail for the committee.
And including a lot of the responses to the questions that have been raised. And
all the questions that have been raised today, we will respond in two ways, in back to as a board memo, and we'll incorporate it into the March presentations to make sure that we're hitting both communication areas. So.
Okay. Any other questions on this presentation, or shall we move into the financials? All right, Kate, let's go to the financials.
So new this month, we've included some summary information. In addition to all of the detail that we normally provide, we've provided some slides that should be on the very top of your detailed financial report. As we've been in previous months, year to date, we're favorable to budget, and we've included a graph on reference the page. Page 35, so you can see year to date, we're $1.1 million favorable to budget, which is good news. The second page.
Can I stop you for just a second?
Sure.
This particular chart, I don't find to be very useful to me. If you gave me cost recovery ratio and where that was, that might tell me something. But this is a percentage variance of a division of two numbers. And by the time I get to the second level, I've lost the meaningfulness of the chart.
Point well taken. This is our first attempt, and I think okay. We agree with you in that comment. Right. So this will be refined for the next presentation. The next slide shows the revenue situation. As we've been reporting all year, we do have an unfavorable variance with our revenue, both on bus and rail. The December numbers are highlighted to the right. 3% down on rail, 2% down on bus. Even with that negative variance to budget, as I mentioned before, we're still favorable because of expenditure savings, and those are detailed on the next slide. So this is I'm sorry, can you go back one? Is there a slide missing? There's a.
I think it's after.
It's after.
Oh, I apologize.
All right, another so this ridership is, before you
right,
get to your expense.
Thank you. So this is obviously the revenue situation. And then the next slide is the expenditures.
Excuse me. On the revenue situation, is there an explanation for this very sharp drop in access revenues?
There was a
that's what I ask every month.
Yeah. There was a one-time revenue adjustment that was made, and I think that explains the – I think that's detailed in the report.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, the next slide, please. I'm sorry. These are out of order.
Ridership.
Yeah, can you go back?
Go to ridership.
All right, so this shows the ridership situation. As we've indicated, year to date, bus ridership is down on average about 6% for monthly ridership year over year, as well as average weekday. And on rail, the ridership is approximately the same as it was last year, slightly above last year's levels, but it's down against budget.
I think that's a very important point, and that is that, as this shows, our rail ridership has, in fact, stabilized. We can't quite say that on bus yet. And compared to last year, it's the same or a little bit larger, which says we're not losing riders. The analysis here is relative to budget, not relative to ridership, prior ridership.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point, and I think I really wish it would say that on the chart. I mean, you could do a line for budget and a line for ridership, and that would show you the same thing. And I have the same problem the chairman had when I'm thinking about this. It is automatic to sort of think we have a decline, and in fact, we don't have as much of an increase as the budget projected.
That's correct.
That's what this chart shows, and it's not intuitive.
Okay, we'll make that more clear for the next
I think you actually need two lines. You need last year's ridership, and you need the projected ridership, and then this would show up in the middle.
And you're basically stuck with the chart that you have in the detailed presentation.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and we'll improve that for next month. I apologize. The next slide shows the expenses. We're under budget on expenditures. The major reasons are power and diesel. You can see just for the month of December, there is a $2 million favorable variance. Year to date, that's 11.3. The other favorable variance is in fringe benefits, $1.2 million for the month of December. Year to date, about $6.3 million. There are some unfavorable items you see there. Overtime, $3.1 million. The majority of that is in the bus overtime that we've discussed before. And finally, materials and supplies. We're over budget $1.4 million for the month of December, about $5.5 million for year to date. Unanticipated supply purchases, such as brakes for rail cars, some unanticipated items. But altogether, under budget on expenditures, under budget on revenues. So the net is that we're favorable to budget by $1.1 million. The next slide.
You're doing a really good job of holding our subsidies. That's good.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you.
It's just rounding, but yeah.
Yeah. The wonders of doing this with computers and rounding.
Mr. Benjamin.
Yes, Ms. Hines.
Can I go back to ridership just for a minute?
Sure.
We got the IG's report that said there were some discrepancies in how bus ridership and stuff has been reported. Is that playing a fact? Is that playing a role in this bus ridership number?
Yes, it is. And what happens is, we have a couple of issues. Farebox is not working, what happens is when they're not working, we have a method where we take a bus out and then we get the backup bus to come in. Sometimes that's not a feasible thing without impacting a lot of customers. We have communication issues. So we have sometimes in our Next Fare 5 system where we're getting ridership 2 weeks later from the fare box. The fare box is probed every day in the bus shop, and as a result, that ridership is sent down to a data centralized data warehouse. Because of the comm issues that we have, that's the issue, and that's the highlight that the audit report highlighted. We have actually what I have formed is a SWAT team that is cross-functional, bus, rail, because rail's impacted as well, and financial people and everything. They're looking at this and making a determination to Dave and myself and Jack Rico where we can fix this. We can do quick fixes. There's some investments that we need to make in order to shore it up, but that's what you're seeing here. Ultimately, it's not as even as we'd like it to be, and then the data will come in on the next month, but we're trying to fix that.
Ms. Kissel, isn't there also a broader issue? And that is we now have many of our bus riders using smart trip cards, which means that we have a pretty good idea of how many people are, in fact, on the buses.
Yeah, so
and how many people are boarding. And our past history has been that an operator has to push a button each time.
Right.
And we don't know how accurate that button pushing is, but we have a pretty good idea as to how accurate the smart trip is. We may be looking at data when we compare to prior years that are inaccurate because of just the process of collecting it.
Right. And that's a great point, because last year we were reliant on non-technology things to account for riders. And now this year we see a 70% increase on smart card usage, and that's an automatic tap. which is very effective for BUS and is able us to capture data more readily. The issue we have on the data capture is more of the infrastructure and comm issues, which we're trying to work out.
So we have some problems with how accurate our timing is on that data, but it is probably substantially better than what it has been in previous years. And the problem is we really don't know whether we were high or low in previous years.
Right, and I don't want to give the impression that we're not collecting revenue, because we are collecting the revenue. It's just that when the ridership count is not appropriately done through these systems, it skewers the results that you have on a month-to-month basis.
Mr. Downs.
I'm glad to hear that you're putting together a task force about the 5 IG findings. Would it be appropriate to have a regular report about the progress on those 5 issues that were raised by the IG?
Yes, we're getting an assessment on this in the next, I think it's 3 weeks from now. It'll be the initial assessment from that team. So we can provide that report to the committee, and you can see the progress and some of the recommendation and options that we're looking to take on that.
And finally, this last table shows where we are with our capital expenditures. As Ms. Kissel noted earlier, our capital budget has increased by about 50% year over year. Even with that, our obligation rate is higher than it was last year, and our expenditure rate is slightly higher than it was last year. One of the major items that one of the major items is noted at the bottom of the page. We made the first payment on the new 7,000 rail cars in December, and so that was a big expenditure item that in the month of December. The reason that this is in two different formats is the first is the core capital program, the old Metro Matters program, and then the core CIP, which is on an expenditure basis. And then the obligation-based programs are listed below, and that includes the stimulus projects, where we've expended just over 50% of the funds, the jurisdiction reimbursable projects, this expenditure is about 70%, and these are multi-year projects, and then safety and security projects that are 100% grant funded. We've obligated nearly almost 10%, but the expenditure rate is about 4%.
Mr. Downs?
Just a question on this table to be sure I understand it. In the element that's expenditure-based, the first column is what we expect to spend in the fiscal year, right?
Right. The first, yeah. The budget right. is, yeah. right, projected expenditure.
The second column, which says obligated, to be logical, must only be that portion of an obligated project that would be spent in the fiscal year. It can't be the obligation of the whole project.
That's correct. I'm sorry.
That could be larger than.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. So each of these columns is a slice of expenditures and what may be a multi-year project.
Right, and the obligations for future year expenditures are not shown here. They would
go. Right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Hines.
Sorry. You've now confused me.
Okay.
Let's look at December 2011 in that expenditure-based year. We plan to spend $844 million, right?
By the end of the fiscal year.
The end of June.
By the end of June, that's the adopted budget.
You have.
These are the fiscal years.
Fiscal years. Okay. You've obligated 575 of that 844.
That's correct.
Right? And what's your definition of how do you define obligated?
The funds are either on a contract or it's labor costs that have been expended.
Okay.
Labor costs are obligated and expended at the same time.
Okay, so we've got 68% of what we plan to spend has been obligated.
That's correct.
Right? And we've expended 30% of the total.
That's correct.
Right? That's 256. And we're halfway through the fiscal year.
That's correct.
So the question I have is how are we going to get to 100 by the end of June?
If you look at a history of our spending, we have a lot of spending that happens in the spring and summer, right? You have, and it's typical of, well, we're not a construction company, but we act like one in some respects. So you have a very big burn rate that happens through the second half of that year. We've actually had a forecast of that spending plan, the $844 million, when PB came in here last month. And what they had projected was something slightly less than the $844 million, but we're running to that forecast. So we expect to meet that forecast.
The PB forecast?
Yes, we expect to meet that forecast. That's correct.
And how much below the 844 was it?
The forecast that you saw last month was at 85%. Spending, and that was the goal that they are working for now. We're looking to do another forecast, and I think that's happening next month. So we'll look at where we are meeting towards that forecast.
Just a little bit of history on this for the newer members. When we came to the stepped up program last spring, we decided we better get the support in-house to move this along. And since we could not ramp up that fast, we brought in an outside PB and whatnot to help us ramp up. What that has helped us do is, if you look from one year to the other, we're obligated and expended a lot more money from one year to the other, but we're not at the rate. And I knew, as I said before, it was going to be a challenge, especially this year, to get there. But we're ramping up things and starting to show, but it'll take a while to get there totally.
A last question along the line of what we're spending and how fast we're spending. Should our level of federal assistance start to drop? What happens?
If the level of assistance, such as the $150 million a year in PREA funds, does not continue?
That or some of our...
That's the one right in front of me, okay. Right. And then there is also the federal formula funds that come right after it.
And
the reason I focus on 150 is there's a continuing resolution which is expiring beginning of March, and while that may continue a little bit, but at some point they're going to have to adopt a resolution that extends it for the rest of the year. And from what I understand, the thing that's in the crosshairs is $150 million. The federal formula funding will probably play more into fiscal year 12, which come soon thereafter in terms of consideration. So if, first of all, if there are a lot of the safety programs are funded by the PREA funds, however, safety comes first, and if those funds disappear, we're going to do the safety issues, but everything else is on the table for reductions. And since the budget only makes up safety and state of good repair, then you're into state of good repair issues that you have to deal with that you won't have the money for.
So it's the elevators and escalators and
things that get into reliability
and track work that will start to,
yep,
to go. This is something I hope we will discuss in more detail next month when we're doing our capital discussion. But what we're saying is there's a very, very real effect that occurs very, very quickly if the Congress were to move in the direction of reducing our capital assistance.
Yes.
Okay. We feel it in fiscal 12.
Yes.
Yeah. Our staggered a year.
Right. Right. We'll make it through this year, but next year.
Correct. Yeah, because we always do in the following fiscal year, whatever the federal funding is. Yeah. But it has a fairly immediate effect on us in this budget that we're starting to look at now.
Right. Right.
I would just like to add one other thing, because as you understand, we have multi-year projects which are associated with multi-year contracts. So breaking contracts, if funding is not available in 12, contributes to the issue that we're going to have on the steady state of good repair. And that can be very expensive.
Okay. I hope we'll explore that some more as we look at the capital budget. Mr. Downs.
I appreciate the note of the 7,000 series car payment. And if you look at the expended, that's about a third of the expenditure so far this year. If you subtract that out, we're at about where we were for regular construction at the same period last year. Does this mean that we may struggle to get the traditional capital expenditures that we've targeted for this year by the end of this fiscal year? Is the $75 million payment masking part of the construction?
We have the goal of 85% spend, which is, last year our spend rate was 68%. So the goal is high, and we're not, the general manager has is holding us to that goal. And that's what we should do. What PB has done for Jack and Dave, myself, who has some capital projects in IT, we're looking at things, a list of projects that says these are the risks, and we look at that on a regular basis. So as we identify risk areas, as you've just identified, we know what projects to move forward. So we're managing that risk plan on a regular basis. And so our hope is to achieve that forecasted spend rate as close as possible. But it's a good point that you make, yes.
Anything else? We also have our subsequent agenda, but it pretty much with the exception of next month with a few action and information items is what we've already discussed. So if there is no more discussion, this meeting is adjourned. And do you want to